Hi, my name is Sam Williams, and welcome to part two of episode number 101 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. First of all, I'd like to welcome all of you to part two of episode number 101 of my 60 Music Podcast, Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and for those of you who are just now discovering this podcast, either on the Apple Podcast app, or in Stitcher, or in iHeartRadio, or in Google Play Music, or on Spotify, and you're wondering, so what the heck is this? I'm just going to give you a brief description of what the show is all about. Okay, so I'm Sam Williams, and I am a 24-year-old songwriter slash producer, but I'm also a huge 60 Music fan slash expert slash nerd. And each week with this podcast, I take one song by one artist from the 60s and put the show in two parts. First part is to talk about my opinion of the song and why I think it's so good or why I think it sucks, and do my own personal analysis on the arrangement of the song, which will include the chords, melody, and lyrics. And the second part of the show, dig deep into the history behind that track. And that part of the show, talk about who wrote the song, who produced it, what studio the song is recorded at, who are the musicians in the track, whether that be the session musicians or the band members themselves, the history behind the artists that recorded the song and the songwriters that wrote it and the producers that produced it, and the history behind the label the song was released on and where the studio the song is located at and where they recorded the song, and also what label the song was released on, where that label was located at, and the year and month the song was released, and the peak position the song made up originally on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. All that is in the second part of the show. But moving on, let's talk about the history behind last week's artists, which is Sam and Dave, and the song Soul Man. But more importantly, let's get into the history behind the label that released this song. You know, because a lot of times nowadays, with a lot of musicians being independent and virtually being their own labels, record labels is oftentimes something we don't really think about in today's world. Because, like I said before, a lot of musicians are putting stuff out on their own labels, and there's really, you don't really need a label anymore. But back in the 60s, it was all about the record labels. I mean, you know, the record labels had so much power back then, and they were one of the biggest movers and shakers in the music industry at that time. They made so much stuff happen. I mean, almost every single song that was released back in the 60s was released on some kind of record label. And it was very rare for artists back then to own their own record labels, you know, or basically be their own label. I mean, you know, it was, you know, because at the time there was no such thing as home recording studios, you know, and a lot of artists weren't really that business savvy. So a lot of times they just got signed to a label that they had no ownership of whatsoever. And this record was no exception to that rule. But anyways, more importantly, we're going to talk about the history behind Stax Records and the very interesting history behind them. We're also going to talk about the history behind the Memphis music scene, because I've done a Memphis song once before on the show, but it was on a different studio and on a different group of musicians and for a different label. But Stax was very much one of the premier record labels in Memphis at the time, and that was a label that the song was released on. And basically what happened with Stax Records is that, before we talk about that, I have to give you a little bit of a background as to what was going on with the Memphis music scene at that time and what the difference was between Memphis and Nashville. Okay, so like a couple weeks ago, before we did episode 100, I talked about the Everly Brothers, who were recording 90% of their songs in Nashville, Tennessee. And the big difference between Nashville and Memphis was that Nashville was all about country music, for the most part. It was either country music or a country version of pop. You know, it was, and again, all the artists that were big out of Nashville and all the musicians that worked up playing all those records, all of them were white, really. You know, and there wasn't, at the time, you know, especially in the early 60s, there weren't too many black musicians who were huge in Nashville at that time. It was all white artists. And there's a reason for that, because Nashville was a segregated city. So there wasn't really too much opportunity for black artists to become huge in Nashville at that time in the early 60s. But that would change once the 60s kind of evolved from the early to mid to late, because a lot of black artists also became huge in Nashville in the late 60s. But in the early 60s, it was all white artists because, you know, at the time, Nashville wasn't really that hip to R&B music, really. It was all basically country or country-politan, or what they call the Nashville sound. It was all country pop. Now, that's what Nashville is all about. But on the other hand, Memphis was the polar opposite of that. In fact, Memphis was very much one of those cities that were the roots of rock and roll, and rhythm and blues were very etched into the city, so deep into their history that, you know, of course, starting with Sun Records, I mean, that's really what, you know, Memphis really, that was the launching point for rock and roll at that time, was Sun Records, you know, with Elvis and Carl Perkins and Jerry Lee Lewis and Johnny Cash and Roy Orbison. I mean, they were all Sun artists. And, you know, I'm not going to bore you with the history of Sun, because I know you already know the history behind them. I mean, Sam Phillips is the owner of the label. You know, all the artists were at the time little known. And then Sam Phillips lost all those artists to different labels. And then he kind of formed his own recording studio. And then, you know, basically his son went defunct. But that's a whole nother story. That was the first little piece of success that Memphis had as a musical city. The next piece of success that Memphis had was this specific label, Stax Records. Now, here's the thing with Stax. What happened with them was that what made Stax so interesting is that in the beginning, you know, it was mainly R&B. It wasn't necessarily R&B music that they were putting out. Stax, in the beginning, was mainly putting out country western or kind of roots country music, and that's what the label owner, Jim Stewart, originally wanted to put out. He wasn't really too interested in putting out R&B music, but it wasn't until he was introduced to Carla and Rufus Thomas, who are, by the way, a father and daughter, you know, who basically, Carla Thomas was Rufus Thomas's daughter. It wasn't until he was introduced to those two people in which he really got interested in R&B music. You know, because when he discovered those two people, he realized that there was this whole underground R&B music scene in Memphis. And at the time, it was very much Southern Soul. And we got to talk about this too, because a lot of people wonder, like, what was the big difference between Motown and Stax? Like, what set them apart? Like, what was the difference between them? Well, I'm going to give you a little analogy here. Motown was essentially like milk chocolate, and Stax Records was very much dark chocolate. And what I mean by that is that Motown was very much, it was milk chocolate because really it was black music written by black people and produced by black people, but it was targeted specifically for white audiences. You know, because Berry Gordy really wanted to target the white market at that time, the white kids buying records by the teen idols and, you know, the girl groups. He really wanted to get into that white market. And essentially, that's what he did. I mean, with all those big Motown acts like Supremes and the Four Tops and Temptations, they were all basically black music that was specifically targeted for white audiences and was tailor-made for the white market. You know, because he really wanted to get those crossover numbers with the white audiences and not just the black audiences. And, you know, and that's basically what he wanted to accomplish. And that's what he did, really. Because if you think about it, all those big Motown records, they all crossed over into the white markets. And, you know, a lot of them featured very lush, you know, string arrangements and, you know, and a lot of the vocals on the songs, a lot of those early Motown songs were pretty white sounding. But Stax was the polar opposite of that. Stax, on the other hand, was really not so interested in the white markets. I mean, they had an interest in them, but really, you know, Stax, the music that came out of Stax Records in the early 60s and in the mid 60s and late 60s, it was the polar opposite of sugar-coated white-sounding R&B music. It was very much blackest sounding R&B music you can hear at that time. I mean, there was a huge emphasis on horns, and the guitar parts that were being played on those records are very gritty, very skanky, very in a lot of those country, you know, guitar licks that were heard on records like Buck Owens and some of those other songs. They were those kind of guitar chicken picking licks were heard. A version of those chicken picking licks were heard on a lot of those Dax records, which, again, it was a lot of these records are very down home, very just not sugar coated, not very sweet, just really, really, you know, good old Southern hospitality, Southern soul. And that's what Dax was really going for. And since they had the sound down to a science, it was very difficult for them to struggle, for them to get to those white audiences and really cross over into those white markets. They really had a hard time with that. And that's why if you look at the history of, Stax Records versus Motown, you'll notice that Motown had way more hits on the pop side. They had way more hits in the pop charts than Stax ever did. But on the other hand, Stax had a lot of hits on the R&B charts. They cornered the R&B charts so well. I mean, they had a lot of number one records on the R&B charts, a lot of top 10s, top 20s, top 30s. I mean, you know, their music, you know, did so well in the R&B charts that they didn't really have a whole lot of competition in that department. And Motown was really, really doing well in the pop charts. But really, Stax, you know, their market was really towards those black teenagers, you know, who really appreciated this music more than the white teenagers at that time. Very much like artists like James Brown. I mean, James Brown was the same kind of deal, except he had nothing to do with Stax Records. He was on a completely different label. But now that you kind of have an idea for what Stax was all about. Oh, another thing that the interesting thing about Stax is that despite the fact that they were based in a southern city, right? I mean, Memphis was in the south. I mean, it wasn't in the north. It wasn't New York or Detroit or Chicago. It was basically a southern city. And at the time, you know, it was during the civil rights movement. And, you know, in the early 60s, segregation was very much legal and very much a part of southern life. Well, with that being said, since you couldn't mix white and black people together in the same room in a public place together, Stax Records had an integrated staff and integrated group of studio musicians, which meant that there was black and white people both working for a label on the publishing and the marketing and the promotion and the distribution side, and there was black and white people playing on the basically playing the music and playing on the hit records. And at the time, it was very illegal for that to happen in the southern city in a state like Memphis or Nashville and Muscle Shoals, but, you know, Memphis, they did it. I mean, they basically broke the rules and basically had both black and white people playing in the band and black and white people working for a label. And at the time, it was very legal for that to happen in Memphis. I mean, that would change once the Civil Rights Act was passed in 64. But really, you know, in the early 60s, it was very legal for that to happen. And they did it. And they had huge success with it. You know, and basically that's what made Stax so revolutionary at the time, is that they were one of the first southern labels to do that. I mean, that was kind of already happening in the northern states, but at the time, northern states didn't really, you know, enforce segregation, unlike the southern states, you know. But basically, Stax, you know, was in a southern town, and they did that, and it was very ballsy of them to do that. And basically, they did it in such a risky way, but still they just had massive success with their group of session musicians and their artists as well. But mainly in the R&B side, not so much in the pop side, but you know, they did have some pretty big hits on the pop charts, so we'll talk about that in just a minute. Okay, so with Stax Records, the two things I want you to remember about Stax is, one, the founder of the label, and his name was Jim Stewart, and his sister, Estelle Axton, and the fact that basically Stax, well, first of all, wasn't even called Stax Records. In the beginning, it was called Satellite Records. That was the original name for label, okay? And the other thing I want you to remember about the label is that, you know, they were, again, a small independent record label with not enough of a big budget for distribution. You know, they didn't have enough money to basically press enough 45s in order to have a huge hit on their hands, you know, if one of their records became popular. So basically what they did at this time is that, you know, they formed a distribution deal with a huge black record label at the time based in New York called Atlantic Records. And the relationship between Stax and Atlantic started very early on. you know. And the one thing I want you to keep in mind about Stax is that even though Stax was very much its own record label, you know, based in Memphis, they recorded out of their own studio, had their own promotion department, and everything was in-house at that time. You know, again, a lot like Motown. I mean, when Motown was totally in-house, so was Stax. But the thing to keep in mind about Stax is that unlike Motown, Stax basically, all their releases were filtered through Atlantic, essentially. And a lot of their artists were also filtered through Atlantic, too. So, again, you know, Atlantic, even though they were a New York label and they had their own artists, their own recording studios, and their own producers, and essentially their own artists, a lot of the artists that were initially on the Stax record label were initially filtered through Atlantic or released on that label. So that's why when we look at a lot of those Stax releases, you know, a lot of them had the Atlantic label on them instead of Stax. Well, that's because Stax had a distribution deal with Atlantic, even though they were mutually kind of exclusive. I mean, Atlantic had their own label with their own studios in New York and their own artists. Stax had their own thing going on, but they had a relationship between each other. So therefore, you know, Stax artists were also released on Atlantic. So there was definitely that crossover there. But essentially, they were mutually exclusive, but they also, you know, Atlantic released a lot of records on Stax, and therefore there is that a lot of those songs were half released on Stax and half released on Atlantic. But anyways, the label Stax Records, again, it was originally called Satellite Records, and it was basically founded by a guy named Jim Stewart, who, by the way, was a white guy, and his sister Estelle Axton. And in the beginning, like I said before, they weren't really too interested in putting out black R&B music. They really were focusing more on country, bluegrass, and some other genres. And that's what they mainly put out in the beginning, like in the late 50s, like in 1958. And essentially what happened was that Stewart's sister, Estelle Axton, actually, you know, took a financial risk and invested $25,000 into the company, you know, to basically make sure that they had their own Ampex tape recorders, so that way they can record their own music. And when Jim Stewart founded a label in the late 50s, he wanted to make sure that he had an A&R man or a producer, someone who would basically be in charge of, one, finding the artists, and two, making sure that the artists were staying on budget when they were recording their songs. And what he got was a guy named Chips Moman. And Chips Moman essentially became the staff R&B producer at the time at Stax. And really, they weren't too interested in putting out R&B music in the beginning. But it wasn't until they found a Memphis DJ and artist named Rufus Thomas. And Rufus had a daughter named Carla. And one of the first major releases on Stax was a duet between Rufus and Carla Thomas. And it did well regionally, but not nationally. But the fact that they got a hold of Rufus and Carla Thomas meant that there was something there. And when Jim Stewart heard Rufus sing and Carla sing, he realized that there was a lot of, you know, appeal and interest in black rhythm and blues music at that time. So he signed Rufus and Carla in, you know, the late 50s, early 60s. And basically what happened after that was that they inherited an old movie theater at the time, which was located in 926 East McLemore Avenue in Memphis, Tennessee. And they decided, you know what, that's going to be our new studio. It's an old abandoned movie theater. Nobody's using it. Let's just use it as a recording studio. And that's exactly what they did. So 926 East McLemore Avenue became Stax Studios. And that's basically the studio where all the major hits out of Stax are recorded in, basically. And one of the first major hits to come out of Stax, but actually crossed over into the pop charts, was Carla Thomas's Gee Whiz Look in His Eyes. But the interesting thing about that song is that even though it was essentially, you know, released on Satellite Records, which also later became Stax Records. And by the way, the name Stax actually comes from basically Jim Stewart's sister, Estelle Axton, and a session musician that got hired on the Stax in 1961 named Charles Packy Axton. So it was essentially a combination between Jim Stewart's sister, Estelle Axon's name, and a session musician that worked for Stax, who I believe was Estelle Axon's brother, Charles Packy Axon. So therefore, it was kind of a Stewart Axon. You know, you get the idea. That's how they got their name. You know, it was Jim Stewart and then Estelle Packy and then Charles Axon. That's how they got the name Stax. But anyways, essentially what happened was that Gee Whiz, look into his eyes. If you listen to that record, it doesn't sound very Southern at all. It's very sugar-coated. There's a string section. It's a ballad. It sounds very Northern soul. And I think this was because, you know, Stax didn't really find their signature sound yet. I mean, it was almost like with Motown, their first couple of hit records that came out of there with Money, That's What I Want. And, you know, basically, you know, Come to Me with Marv Johnson. I mean, you know, they hadn't quite found their signature sound yet. So they were kind of experimenting, playing with different things. You know, the early Motown records are pretty gritty. And Stax, on the other hand, it was opposite of that. Their early records are very, you know, very not, you know, gritty or, you know, soulful. I mean, they're very sort of sugar-coated Northern soul. And that's kind of what Gee Whiz, look into his eyes was. But that was their first major hit for Stax, and it crossed over to the pop charts. I mean, it was a huge hit, you know, on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. But then what happened after this song, you know, basically the rhythm section for Stax Records was formed, and then the studio musicians came to work for Stax, and I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. And just an FYI, the reason why the company changed its name from Satellite Records to Stax Records is because when Gee Whiz, look into his eyes, when that was released on the Satellite label, which again got distributed by Atlantic, a record label in California was also had the name Satellite Records, and they got in some legal trouble because, you know, they realized they had the same name as another label and they had to change their name because they didn't want to get themselves confused with the Satellite label out of California. So therefore, they changed their name to Stax Records, again, from, you know, Jim Stewart and Estelle Axon, you know, those names kind of combined. Okay, so another thing I wanted to mention to you guys is that the first hit that Carla Rufa Thomas had as a duet was a song called 'Cause I Love You, and that was a song that was distributed by Atlantic Records. And one important thing I want to keep in mind to you is that when Jim Stewart signed a contract with Atlantic as their distributor, he did not read it, and that was not a good idea on his end because, you know, he later got into a jam with Atlantic. And, you know, and basically, you know, Stax severed their relationship with Link. But I'll talk more about that in a second. But first, let's talk about the backbone of Stax. And that was their house band and how the house band came about. They're actually the way they were got involved with Stax was essentially this. Jim Stewart signed a group that Chips Moman was going to produce called the Royal Spades, and that group was also changed their name to the Marquees, and in that group contained members of what would become known as both Booker T and MGs, which was again the rhythm section on Stax, and the Memphis Horns, and a lot of those guys would later go on to play on all the big Stax Records hits, the songs released by Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Carla and Rufus Thomas, and the ones released by book group Booker T and the MGs. Now, the group that was in the Marquees consisted of these musicians: Booker T. Jones and Isaac Hayes on piano, and Donald Duck Dunn and Louis Steinberg on bass, and Al Jackson Jr. on drums, and Steve Cropper on guitar. Now, A lot of the horn players, again, which were very prominent, a lot of those Stax Records were also in the Marquees, and again, they would change the name to Memphis Horns later. And these guys included Gilbert Kappel and Wayne Jackson, Floyd Newman, Andrew Love, and these were the guys that were essentially the horn section on all those records. And they actually had a huge hit in 1961 under their own name called Last Night. And this was definitely the biggest hit song for Stax at this time because it was a top 10 both R&B and a pop hit. It was on the top 10 on both those charts. And it was probably the biggest crossover hit at that time, you know, for Stax. And essentially when they signed the Royal Spades, which changed their name to the Marquees, Stax had their rhythm section pretty much set. And another thing, another cool thing that Stax did at this time, and this also set them apart from Motown, is that Stax also had their own record store. And Estelle Axon, who was the co-founder of the company along with Jim Stewart, she worked at the record store. And it was there that they really learned really what was going on with the record business and what the kids liked to listen to and what they were into at that time and what records sold well and which ones didn't. They really learned a lot about that when they had their own little record store. And a lot of the local kids in Memphis would go to the record store and buy Stax singles. And they also had singles from other labels as well. But mainly the Stax satellite imprint is what they were putting out, you know, and distributing through their own little record store. And basically, you know, that's how they really learned about the record business was from having their own little record store. And that's what really set them apart from Motown, because Motown didn't even have that, really. I mean, they had relationships with the record stores, you know, because, again, they were a record label. They had to distribute their song somewhere. But, you know, essentially, they had their own record store, and that was really, really prominent. And the other thing to keep in mind about, again, the Marquees, you know, were essentially a mixed group. I mean, it was black and white guys. And, you know, Booker T. Jones is in that group. And, you know, he was already kind of a regular session musician on Stax, because he actually played on Cuz I Love You, the first single put out by Carlin and Rufus Thomas. And Donald Duck Dunn was also part of that group as well. And, you know, Booker T. and the MGs, you know, they had a hard time getting a lot of gigs in Memphis at the time, you know, in the South, because they were an integrated band, and, you know, a lot of venues wouldn't tolerate such a group, you know, and so they had a hard road trying to get gigs. But one thing I will say is that, you know, as successful as a band they were, because they were huge, I mean, they were one of the top instrumental groups at the time, along with the Ventures. I mean, they just had a lot of hits doing strictly instrumental music, everything from Green Onions to Time Is Tight, you know, to Hip Hugger to Soul Limbo. I mean, they just had a lot of hits, you know, just as an instrumental group. They were much more appreciated in Europe than they were in America, because in Europe, they didn't really give a fuck. I mean, they really just, you know, it didn't matter if they were purple for all they cared. I mean, basically, you know, in Europe, they were like, fuck it, we'll have these guys play these gigs, because, again, they were the house band on a lot of these records, essentially. And, again, so here's the thing. So when Booker T and the MGs are playing on all these hits, you know, again, they were the sax rhythm section, Donald Duck Dunn on bass, you know, Steve Cropper on guitar, Booker T. Jones on organ, and Al Jackson Jr. on drums. At this time, you know, Stax was starting to expand its repertoire of artists. I mean, they had Carlin Rufus Thomas already, and they were having very good success with R&B hits like Walking the Dog and, again, Gee Whiz, Look at His Eyes. But they wanted to sign some other artists too, and that's when they picked up Otis Redding. And here's the thing, is that Otis Redding actually had a lot of hits in the R&B charts, and not so much in the pop charts, but, again, he was a huge R&B star, and he had hits like These Arms of Mine, and he had a lot of R&B hits. You know, I've Been Loving You Too Long, and, you know, again, he was on Stax Records, and he was discovered in 1962-63, and he was signed to Stax because of how good of a singer he was, and also how well of a songwriter he was, because he really wrote most of his own songs. And he became friends with Steve Cropper, and Steve Cropper co-wrote a lot of his songs, too. You know, but really, Otis Redding was the de facto artist on Stax Records, and, you know, and he was kind of the poster boy of the label. But they also signed a duo, which was last week's artist, and I'm going to talk about the history behind them in a few minutes. But first, I want to mention that what made Stax kind of interesting as far as, you know, their group of session musicians and their productions work is concerned is that, you know, at the time, you know, Motown and, well, I mean, for the most part, in New York, Nashville, Los Angeles, Chicago, all the sessions were very much planned out ahead of time. I mean, the arrangements were written out ahead of time. You know, the producers knew exactly which studio musicians they wanted to use. Everything was basically, it was kind of like a movie. I mean, the script was kind of already written, and the, you know, the actors were the musicians, you know, basically playing the parts, really. You know, so everything was so much controlled and so much planned out ahead of time. But with Stax, it was totally different, because what made them different was that they used something known as head arrangements. And basically what that meant is that before the session started, the song was written, but as far as the arrangement and the parts was concerned, nothing was planned out ahead of time. None of the musicians knew what they're going to do before the session started. So when they got in the studio to record the songs, they made up the parts as tape was rolling. They were figuring stuff out as the session was starting. And, you know, the musicians had a lot more control over what they wanted to do for the parts. And, you know, they made things up as they went. I mean, they didn't really have a specific planned out, written out arrangement. That was pretty much industry standard at the time, you know, for most, producers and, you know, songwriters back then. They had everything had to be planned out so perfectly, you know, everything. And the musicians are basically, again, like actors playing the parts. I mean, the script was already written, and that the arrangements were already written, so the musicians had to play exactly what was written down. And Stax wasn't like that at all, and complete polar opposite of New York, because New York was, again, very, very, you know, written out. You know, script was already written, the musicians had to play the parts, you know, so and the arrangements were already written, so they couldn't really improvise. But the whole thing about Stax is that every part of the arrangements of the songs were totally improvised, and even some of the songs are improvised too. I mean, some of the songs wouldn't be written until the musicians went in the studio to figure out which parts they wanted to do, you know. So again, that improvisational sort of head arrangements thing, you know, attracted, you know, guys like Tom Dowd, who are engineers working for Atlantic in New York. And when he went to Stax to, you know, see that for himself, he was totally surprised, and something about that totally attracted him. And that's why Ahmet and Jerry sent a lot of their artists to Stax, and that's why, you know, basically they had a lot of success. And essentially they did a lot of that with Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, and Sam and Dave too. Okay, so basically what happened with the history behind Sam and Dave is that they were basically two soul singers that started out doing mainly gospel music, right? And basically what happened was that, you know, they were gospel singers, and they actually met each other in Miami, Florida. And you know, they were in gospel groups, and they started singing together, I want to say, in the early 60s. And their first record deal actually wasn't with Stax. It was with a different label, and they were signed, you know, to label by a local Miami producer and songwriter named Steve Alamo, who was also a singer at the time. And he signed them to, after seeing them, you know, at doing a show at the King of Hearts nightclub in Miami, and that label was called Marlin Records, you know, because essentially they were doing gospel music at the time, you know, and they basically, you know, Sam was doing amateur nights, you know, with, you know, according to Dave, you know, doing, you know, basically gospel music. And they decided, hey, you know, I think we could be a really good duo together, you know, and that's when they kind of formed. And basically what happened was that the Marlin label was owned by a guy named Henry Stone. And Henry Stone basically helped them get signed to another big label, which, again, not a Stax label, based in Memphis, called Roulette Records, which is based in New York. And when they were signed to Roulette, you know, they didn't really have that much success. And basically what happened was that when Henry Stone was realizing that he wasn't really, having too much success with an artist, he owned a label that they were signed to. He decided, you know what, I think we need to give these guys another chance. I think there's a lot of potential here, you know. So basically what happened was that, and by the way, Henry Glover produced a lot of Sam and Dave stuff. And Henry Glover, like I said, like last week, produced a lot of stuff for Tommy James and Shawn Dells, and he co-wrote. Actually, he was a sole writer on California Sun, which is a big hit for Rivieras, and that was covered by the Ramones, but that's a whole other story. But anyways, basically what happened was that Stone, who was the owner of the Marlin label Miami, basically introduced the duo to Jerry Wexler, who was the head of Atlantic. And, you know, basically he said, look, you know, these guys are really, really good. I want you to sign them, but you think you can find a home for them? And then Wexler, what he did is that he asked Stax Records, who had a distribution deal with, you know, hey, do you want to sign these guys? And basically what sold Stacks and Sam and Dave is just how, you know, the Southern roots and the gospel style of their performances, you know, live, you know, was really what sold Stacks and Sam and Dave. I mean, they had the grit and they had that blackness to their, you know, to their voices. And basically that's how they got signed, you know, to, you know, Stacks. But again, you know, they were, since they were discovered by Jerry Wexler, they were actually on the Atlantic label. They weren't really on the Stacks label, but they were on the Atlantic label, leased over to Stacks. And then that's basically what happened, was that, you know, they, when they got signed to Stacks, they were paired up with a songwriter named, a producer named Jim Stewart, you know, and basically what happened was that, you know, they were worked with Jim Stewart for a while. They weren't really having much success. And then that's when they met Isaac Hayes and David Porter. Isaac Hayes and David Porter were the essential gold mine of the writers and producers behind Sam and Dave's songs. They wrote all the hits, produced all the hits, and essentially they were kind of like the duo behind the duo. I mean, Isaac Hayes and David Porter were two black guys that were essentially the working duo between Sam and Dave, who were basically just the singers of their work. I mean, they wrote the songs, they produced the songs, and essentially, you know, they had Booker T and the MGs, you know, basically playing the music behind them. I mean, Steve Cropper on guitar, Booker T. Jones on organ, you know, Don Duck on bass, and Al Jackson Jr. on drums and the Memphis horns. I mean, those are basically, you know, again, they were called the Marquees first, and they changed their name to Booker T and the MGs and the Memphis horns. But essentially, they became the masterminds behind their music, and their first major hit, you know, on Stacks was You Don't Know Like I Know. But again, that was an R&B hit, not a pop hit. And then the first major pop hit was Hold On, I'm Coming, which came out in March of 66, and that was big. That was really what sold, you know, them on the pop charts, was that specific song. And then a year later, they came out with this one, which was called Soul Man, which is their iconic hit song. And how the song was written was that Isaac Hayes and David Porter were watching the 12th Street riots that are happening in Detroit, Michigan in 1967. You know, just the race riots going on with, you know, basically, you know, police brutality and racism. A lot of what we're kind of re-experiencing right now, essentially. You know, they were watching these race riots on TV, just like how we were watching the race riots on TV just a couple weeks ago, earlier this month, you know, late May, early June, what happened with the, you know, the killings of those black people by the white police. But that's besides the point. Anyways, they were watching basically the exact same thing in 1967. But what happened, what inspired them to write the song, is that they saw the black people writing on the walls of these buildings the word soul on, you know, these walls. And they were like, that's pretty cool. It's pretty interesting. I didn't really realize that. And basically what happened was that they were writing the word soul on the walls. And like, you know what? Maybe we can write a song about that. And basically what they did is that, you know, they... David Porter described what the Soul Man was as somebody who was basically someone, a black guy, well, maybe just a guy in general, who was overcoming all the obstacles and all the problems that he was having in his life, and just step over that and be a successful person, you know. And basically that's what they described a Soul Man is, and someone who, again, someone who had a lot of soul, and somebody who was kind of overcoming those obstacles. And, you know, it was basically a black pride thing, because he was kind of boasting about, oh yeah, I'm a soul man. Well, basically that's what the song is about. It's a boasting black pride song, but it's really, really good. And that's how the song was written, essentially. And by the way, there's one more a couple interesting things about the song before I close out this episode. There's one specific part where one of them says, play it, Steve. And what he did, that was totally improvised, totally off the cuff. He wasn't really supposed to do that, but he did it anyways, and the producers like it, and they just left it in. Basically, what he did is that he was shouting out to Steve Cropper, who played guitar in the session, and, you know, it was one of those rare instances where the artist basically shouted out one of the session musicians who was playing on the song. I mean, the only other real example of this is on Sam Cooke's Little Red Rooster. He shouts out the musicians who are playing on the song. Well, that's basically what one of them did on Soul Man. And the song was released in, so I actually want to take that back. It was actually released in September of 67. It became a huge hit in October of that year. It was a top 10 record, easily the biggest hit that Sam and Dave ever have. I think it was released, I think it peaked at number three, actually. It was a number three hit, or it might have been number two. It was either one of those. It was in the top five. It was a huge hit. And the next hit song was a song called I Thank You. Now, basically what happened is that one, before I end this episode of this podcast, I'm wanting to talk with you about kind of what happened sort of at the end of the 60s, because Stax would continue to have huge hits in the 70s. But what happened in the end of the 60s is that, unlike what happened with Motown, Stax lost one of their biggest, most successful, commercially successful artists, who was kind of up and coming on the pop charts, but having a lot of hits in the R&B charts. Otis Redding died of a plane crash in December 1967, and that was a big change, game changer for Stax, because they were heartbroken by the loss of Otis Redding. There was one, it was one of their biggest artists, and half of the band, the Bar Keys, which were another big act on Stax, which happened to be Otis Redding's backing band live, they also died in the plane crash. So this was a big blow to Stax, and they were really heartbroken by this. And they were like, well, shit, I mean, we got to find other artists, you know, other than Stax to basically, you know, be our breadwinners. And basically what happened was that, you know, Jim Stewart got kicked out of the label, and then Al Bell became the man, the label's main producer and the new executive for Stax. And what happened after this was that, remember what I said earlier, that Stax had a distribution deal with Atlantic? Well, what happened was that Jim Stewart didn't really read that contract, and what happened was that Atlantic basically gained the distribution, exclusive distribution rights to Stax Records. And basically what happened was that all the major artists that were on Stax essentially became Atlantic artists, because Atlantic had exclusive ownership over the Stax artists. And that's basically what happened. I mean, you know, most of the artists that, when Atlantic got bought by Warner Brothers, all the artists that were on the Stax label, they all went to Atlantic. And essentially Atlantic became the sole owner of Stax Records, and Stax was no longer considered an independent label at that time. And essentially what happened was that they trudged through quite a bit. I mean, they had Who's Making Love by Johnny Taylor and, you know, Time is Tight by Booker T and the MGs. They were continuing to have very big success, and even with the staple singers, you know, in the early 70s with Expect Yourself, you know. But again, I feel like, you know, what happened was that with Wilson Pickett, for instance, he was an artist that was started off as Stax. A lot of what happened was that a lot of artists that were on the Stax label actually went over to Muscle Shoals to record too, because what happened was that since a lot of those artists were on the Atlantic label, essentially, they decided they wanted to go to Muscle Shoals to record instead, because for whatever reason, they liked the musicians down there better and the studios were down there were better. So essentially what happened was that a lot of Stax artists, like the Staple Singers and Wilson Pickett, they went down to Muscle Shoals and most of their hits down there. You know, so essentially there was that big crossover happening between, you know, Stax in Memphis, you know, and in the studio, Fame Studios in Muscle Shoals, Alabama. I mean, Aretha Franklin was supposed to go to Stax to record, but she wound up actually going to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and then she went back to New York. So again, it was a big crossover thing happening between Stax in Memphis and Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and New York. It was all kind of very intertwined with each other, and basically that's what the history is behind Stax. And if there's anything you want to remember about them, is that one, they were an integrated label. All the staff that worked for Stax were both black and white, and they were integrated, you know, musicians who played on these records in the southern city of Memphis at the time. It was very legal for a segregated band to have, you know, to be playing together in the same room in a private space, you know, and even in public too. I mean, basically they wanted to make sure that, you know, black and white people were separate, but they completely said fuck you to that. And they basically said they wanted to have, you know, black and white people in the same room together. And that's basically what made Stax so special, is that they basically, you know, they completely bucked that rule and basically had black and white musicians working together in the same room. And that's what made them revolutionary, because they were one of the first Southern labels to do that. And also, again, they were way more successful in the R&B charts than they were in the pop charts. Again, their music was very targeted towards the black market, and they weren't trying to really cross over too much on the white audiences market, even though they had some huge crossover hits like Sit and Talk and Baby Otis Redding, Soul Man by Sam and Dave. I mean, those were huge crossover hits in the pop charts, but really they were gearing their music towards that black market. And again, their music was really horn heavy, you know, lots of skanky guitar parts, you know, and really cool bass lines too. Very similar to what James Ingram was playing in Motown, but a little bit different, but still, you know, again, it was very much black music geared towards the black audiences, and they had way more hits in the R&B charts than the pop charts. But that's basically the gist of what Stax was all about. They were an independent label that got released to Atlantic, and they really were essentially the de facto, you know, independent label in Memphis. And also, the studio is still around today. You can actually go and visit the Stax studio, and you can check it out. And you can there's books and documentaries about the history behind the label Stax. But I mean, I'm gonna try to keep it short for right now. But basically, that's what Stax studio was all. That's what the Stax label was all about. And hopefully, you learn a lot of cool stuff about them in this week's episode of the podcast. So that concludes part two of episode number 101 of my 60 Music Podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. I'm Sam Williams, and if you found out some really cool, interesting facts about last week's song, and you never really knew anything about it before, and you actually know the song, but you're kind of surprised to find out some really cool, interesting facts about this particular song, you never really knew anything about it before. And by the way, one more thing. If you're wondering what the term, when he means when he says I was educated in Woodstock, well, basically the origin behind that is that there was a school in Memphis, Tennessee called, I think it was a middle school called Woodstock Middle School. And basically, you know, one of the writers in the song envisioned this place where a lot of black kids would go to learn important things, and the school would be made out of wood sticks. And basically, that's what the song is about. That's what that reference is. He was envisioning a school made out of wood sticks, and there was a school in Memphis, Tennessee called Woodstock, and that's where that title comes from. But yeah, so if you learned some really cool, interesting facts about last week's song and artist in this episode, you never really knew anything about them, you can email me at samltwilliamicloud.com, and you can also reach out to me on Instagram, iHeartOldies. Now, my website is still under construction. I'll let you guys know when I'm done with it, but I'm definitely working on it, and I know that it'll be up again pretty soon. For now, you can just hit me up on Instagram or email me if you want to reach out to me. And yeah, so also you can check out the official Spotify and YouTube playlist for this podcast. You'll be able to find all the songs I've talked about on my show so far, including some ones that I've covered in interview episodes, like the one I did last week, a couple weeks ago. But anyways, hopefully that'll give you some ideas for some songs that I've covered on my show so far that I haven't talked about yet. You know, by listening to this playlist. And if you have any of those ideas, you want to send those to me, you can do that. The email me at samltwilliamicloud.com or reach out to me on Instagram at iHeartOldies. Also, you can check out the official Redbubble merch store for this podcast. We'll be able to find the super cool logo that I didn't design, but I had someone else design, but I came up with the idea for it. It's to name of my podcast and Keep On Trucking Tie-Dye Fun the bottom with the catchphrase I say at the end of every episode of my podcast in the top. You know, also Keep On Trucking Tie-Dye Fun, and I love if you can go on there. The merch is made by Redbubble. You can go on there and you can check it out and buy and hopefully buy something. If you don't want to, that's okay, but I love it if you could at least give me some feedback on the price of each item in the store. You can do that by emailing me at samltwilliamicloud.com. By the way, there was an issue when I tried to purchase an item for someone as a gift. Redbubble sent them the wrong logo attached to the shirt, and I'm in the middle of trying to figuring out what's going on with that now. So I'll let you guys know when that is resolved. But just a FYI, if any of you guys want to try to buy anything from my store, you know, there was a problem with that. I'm in the middle of getting that fixed right now. But yeah, so anyways, I'm Sam Williams, and thank you guys for joining me and listening to this episode of my podcast, The Millennial Throwback Machine. Until next week, police! Keep things moving.